Today, some thoughts about civility and civilization.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now, the topic civility and civilization is a pretty high-minded way to come into the topic I actually want us to cover today, and for the reason that I'm bringing it up. However, it is central. The reason I said it this way is because it is central to the ideas that we'll be discussing at the end of the conversation that we get to today. But you'll be able to see why. I mean, because the events that are provoking me toward this topic, the topic for today, are the shootings that have taken place just recently, and in some cases, very close to home. So the shooting a couple of weeks ago in Allen, as I'm recording this, that took place last week in Allen, Texas, and other mass shootings that have taken place recently, which unfortunately we can say every single day, you know, the mass shootings that took place recently, because we're averaging more than one per day in terms of mass shootings in 2023, where there are at least four victims of the shooting in addition to the perpetrator. So it is something going on in the culture we need to talk about, and it's even closer to home for me, at least to bring it up now. I only mean this in this way, for me to have to bring it up, for a couple of reasons. One, that it is close to me, Dallas suburb, just recently, the shooting in Allen. But also my grandkids being affected by the shooting that took place in the school in Nashville, not too far from their own home and from the school they attend. So for me, these things have hit close to home recently, and therefore I want to talk about them. But there's another reason that I want to talk about it, which is sort of contrarian, but I think in an essential way, in a way that needs to happen. I make fun of myself for being a contrarian and for sort of wanting to wade into things that take the opposite view of everyone else, or at least provoke a conversation where everyone else wants to be quiet. I can make fun of that at times, but at times it's essential. Someone needs to do it. And unfortunately, and it just crushes me that this is the case, it confuses me in some ways. If I didn't understand it, I would be completely confused. And I know that sounds like it should have explained itself, but the point is, it's so awkward to bring this topic up in a Christian setting because people become so defensive about it, which is not, it is, I am put out of my mind. I'm beside myself with dismay that it has come to this point that I want to talk about the violence that's taking place with all the shootings that are happening in our communities. And therefore, I want to bring up the topic of guns and what we do about them. And yet, that's going to be a major problem with a lot of people in the Christian community. That can even be a meaningful sentence is a reason for us to have this conversation today. And it is a meaningful sentence, and you know it. What I want to do is just, it's not just to talk about guns, it is to talk about gun violence, and in particular, the type of violence that's been happening lately that we've associated with mass shootings, and especially with assault weapons. And I know you're saying to yourself, oh, only assault weapons are only involved in 26% of the shootings, blah, blah, blah. We'll get into all that later, or some of it later, the parts that are relevant. But I just want to have a conversation about the things that sort of make sense, obviously, if we can just sit down together and have the conversation. And I've made the arguments against gun control for decades. And so I think it makes sense for us to sit down and, knowing that background about me, be able to say, well, what What should we be thinking about? And there are things that people are referring to right now as common sense solutions, common sense restrictions on guns, that people are sort of agreeing that we ought to do, something we ought to act on. And I mean by that some of the guidelines that people have been laying down for, you know, setting up red flag laws, and we'll get into all those later on also, but red flag laws and also criminal background checks at gun shows and things like that. The things that sort of seem obvious, raising the age for someone to be able to buy an assault weapon and so on. They don't seem like they're onerous restrictions, or that they strip us of all of our liberties or rights. There is still some pushback against it because there's a sense that any restriction is a slippery slope toward the complete abandonment of liberty in our society. I get that. I understand the argument. So what I want to do is just start out talking about the notions that lead us toward those things that we talk about as common sense solutions. And the way people describe it is, why can't we just implement common sense solutions for obvious problems, right? So let me lay down a couple of caveats, but also a couple of responses to those to say it does make sense for us to be talking about this. And in fact, it doesn't make sense not to be talking about it anymore. And so the first caveat I'll lay down, the first little cautionary flag I'll lay down, is a recognition that there is a problem anytime we try to appeal to common sense as a solution to things. There is a problem that comes with that I especially appreciate as a philosopher. I'm not a great philosopher, but anybody who does philosophy at all knows there's something to be cautious about when everyone says, well, it's just common sense. Because forever it was common sense that the earth is flat. And if you're a flat earther, oh, let's have a different conversation. Something's wrong. There are curves that just don't make sense. So anyway, we'll get back to that another day. The point is, we know the earth's not flat, but common sense says we build a building that's flat. And so I get that there's a reason for us to recognize that there are problems with the ways we think of things being solved with common sense. It's the reason Kant writes his philosophy, the recognition that common sense is simply a way of saying, this is the way everyone thinks about it, and you're not allowed to think differently. It's an imposition of mob mentality in some cases, and that's not okay. It's the reason sometimes people will live in a way that is backwards, and I don't care about, I'm not talking about technology or anything like that, but I mean morally, in sort of a retrograded position, because it's just common sense. That's how my granddaddy raised me, and so that's what we do. And surely, over the decades, we've learned that some of the things previous generations did were actually wrong. It doesn't mean they're more evil than we are, but it does mean we've learned not to do those things, and so we don't do them anymore. So common sense always puts up a little red flag, and I'll say it that way for you because we'll be using the term later. It puts up a little flag for me and says, let's be cautious about this and think about it. Is that common sense actually defensible? But here's the thing. All that philosophical approach to common sense solutions, you know, when you say, as a philosopher, well, of course the crowd believes that, but for those of us who have thought deeply and stared into our belly button long enough, we understand that, and we know deeper things or something like that. The reality is, even philosophers, and you can read Descartes' Meditations and know that he knew this. René Descartes, sort of the father of modern philosophy. He is fodder for a lot of people's modern philosophy. But anyway, the point is, even Descartes knew that philosophy is for the moments when you're not drowning. You can't, when you're drowning, think to yourself, now wait a minute. Now let's take a minute. I know common sense says swim to the surface. I know common sense says get to shallower water. I know common sense says get your head above water. But let's think about this for a minute, because, you know, oxygen is in H2O. That's the O in water, H2O. And maybe there's a way to break it down so that we're not, and then you're dead, you know, that you can't do philosophy when you're drowning. you do philosophy when the bills are paid and when you have a sponsor and when you've got a job, a position, and you can teach and, you know, that kind of stuff. When you can back up and you're not just trying to find food to get through the night, right? So I get that. And in that's the reason that I think it's important for us to be willing to use a word like common sense when we're looking at catastrophe after catastrophe. And I don't, and if you think the word catastrophe is an exaggeration, then I think you just aren't paying attention to the trauma that's inflicted on these communities when this happens. I don't think it's an exaggerated term. And in this moment when the communities are drowning in this, for us to say, well, I know you think it's common sense, but in reality, we really need to stop and analyze this with a lot more detail. I am for analyzing, but I'm also for, in moments of urgent need, using a little common sense to solve an obvious problem. Second caveat, obvious problem. Anybody with any life experience knows that symptoms and causes can be two different things. They often are two completely different things. I mean, when you have downed emotions, you're just sad all of the time, and in reality, you have clinical depression of some kind. I can't diagnose that. I'm not qualified to. My producer, Daisy, is. I'm not. But if you did, if you had some kind of clinical depression, treating it as only an emotion, as though the primary symptom of sadness is the only thing that is the symptom you're experiencing, you know, the thing that makes you go to somebody and say something's wrong, or that other people see in you and makes them say something's wrong, treating it as if sadness is the only thing that's going on, that there's nothing deeper that needs to be dealt with than that, you know, would be a mistake. So, admittedly, there is, a caution that we need to put out there when we say, well, the problem's obvious. He's sad. Let's just make him happy. You know, let's fix it. That may not fix the problem at all because we may not have recognized the problem. I get that. But in the same way that I was saying a moment ago, and by the way, along with this, there is a common problem, meaning we recognize a problem and we say, well, it's just so obvious. This is the problem. There is an inductive fallacy. And for instance, one example of the inductive fallacy that applies here when we're talking about these mass shootings is hasty generalization. Now I'm going to pause and just get a handhold for us on where I am in the conversation. I think we need to talk about doing something different regarding guns in our society. So I think we ought to have more conversations about legitimate restrictions on where guns are and who has them and how freely we distribute them and use them in society and how we regard them ourselves. That's where I'm going. But on the way there, I want to acknowledge we have to have an intelligent conversation about it. And by that, I don't mean smarter than everybody else. I just mean we need to have a conversation that's thoughtful enough that it recognizes that the persistence of disagreement about this topic that has got us stalled in the mud on it is more than just stubborn ignorance. There are opinions on both sides that need to be understood and heard. And if you say the same thing over and over for once or twice or three times, fine, then you just try again. But if you try it over and over for 5 and 6 and 7 decades, and the other side doesn't change their mind at all, they're not all idiots on either side. So somebody's not, and on both sides we end up doing this, somebody's not thinking through why the other side is saying what they are. And so I'm just laying down some awareness of the things that need to inform the later part of the conversation that I want to have about the fact that we need to consider something different because something's not working. Something is wrong. And if we can't see that something is wrong, we just have our head in the sand. We're just pretending because it's obvious something is wrong. Now, again, I'm saying that and then acknowledging, saying there's an obvious problem does raise a little flag and say, well, you're committing an inductive fallacy here. You're making a hasty generalization. You see, you saw this assault weapon at one shooting or at 20 shootings, and then you concluded that that thing, whatever that is the sine qua non of every one of these situations. It's the thing that makes it the case, and that's a fallacy. It's an inductive fallacy that people make. It's similar to the fallacy of accident. In fact, it's a form of the fallacy of accident that takes place. If I were to go to Des Moines, why do I choose Des Moines? Because I've never been there. And I don't even think I've ever been in the state. Maybe I've driven through the state. Des Moines in Iowa, right? Am I thinking correctly? Okay, good. I'm just joking. Of course I know Des Moines in Iowa. The point is, I mean, I say that. You don't know whether I know or not. But just take my word for it, sort of. Anyway, the point is, if I meet someone rude in Des Moines, and then I judge all Iowans to be a menace to society, then I'm making a hasty generalization. I'm taking the fact that this rude person happens to be, this is fallacy of accident now, from Des Moines, from Iowa, as indication that all Iowans must be rude. That's the same kind of error. I don't have enough data to draw that conclusion, but I draw the conclusion. And the reality is that I haven't gotten enough data for it. But the other reality is that deep analysis of data and sources, just like philosophy is for moments when you're not drowning, deep analysis of data and the sources of information that we have, that's for moments when you're not being eaten alive by something. You know, I think most lions are good. This one is eating me, but I'm pretty sure the other ones are, and then you just don't finish the sentence because you're dead. At some point when you're being eaten, you have to recognize that you probably trusted something you shouldn't have trusted. And something is going wrong. Something is wrong. Surely we can acknowledge something's wrong. Just looking at the deaths, the suffering that's going on right now. So yes, admitting, there are caveats in this conversation that I think are real and that are something that have to be addressed. And yet, some problems are obvious. And some improvements regarding those problems are just as obvious as the problems themselves. And I think we need to talk about some of those. So, you know, let's figure out at least what we want to talk about after a shooting like the one that took place in Allen just recently, or up in Nashville, or in any of the other places around the country where it's happened too often recently. So first, in general, gun violence. And yes, I realize that there are mass incidences of violence that don't involve guns. Some people are using a van to drive into a crowd or another kind of vehicle to drive into a crowd and target people. I get that. I'll mention that later on. But let's just talk about gun violence for a moment. It's, you know, because the idea that you wouldn't talk about drownings because some people die because of overdoses, it's just nonsensical. If you can keep people from drowning, you keep them from drowning. And yeah, it's true that that doesn't help with the people who overdosed, but it does help with the people who drowned, right? That's not a complicated idea. So what we ought to do is figure out what we actually are talking about when we talk about shootings like the one that took place in Allen. So in general, and I'm no expert on gun violence. I'm just not. It's not a thing I research every day. It's not something I've developed a skill for being able to talk about. I'm coming at this as a believer who analyzes all kinds of stuff in our culture and society and figures out where it fits into this intersection of how we live together as people in a culture that have to have an ethic that unites us, and then how we live in that culture and society as believers who have a commitment to a different Lord, right? So I'm just trying to look at it from that perspective and give some thought to it. So, it's not hard to find some information, and in looking at information, especially if you go online to look it up, I'll give you a couple of sources. In our links on our website, you'll be able to link to these sources. They're just minor sources. I mean, major media sources. You can say, I don't trust the major media, but that's a different problem that we can discuss for a different day. Because the reality is, if you just apply a little, and I'll say common sense, but it doesn't matter whether everybody agrees with you or not, if you just apply a little bit of thinking in your own mind about what coheres, what fits together of all the data that you're receiving, it's not that hard to figure out that these shootings really are happening. You know, when it comes to your community, you can't pretend it didn't happen. You can't listen to some wacko on the radio describe a mass shooting as fraudulent and then say, well, I don't even believe it happened, because it happened to people in your own neighborhood. Your own people are affected by it. And the idea that other people are pawning this off on us as some kind of fraudulent problem in our society, that's just not good enough. You're just that you got to get your head out of the sand. That's just not the case. So here are some basic ideas that we ought to consider. First of all, narrowing down the topic so that we can talk about real solutions regarding the problem we're actually describing. So sometimes we'll describe a solution and then we'll describe the problem in such broad terms that the solution doesn't really apply to it. So in general, gun violence is a huge problem in the United States. 13,900 people killed in gun violence so far in 2023. That's the headline on ABC News. And by the way, the article is nuanced. The article does have all the details in it to follow through. This article from ABC News that I have linked from go.com or whatever. And again, you can find it linked in our website. But, you know, out of those, there are a lot of those incidents that have nothing to do with the topic that we're trying to respond to today. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a response that involves those things as well. For instance, the guns that are used in suicides. More than half of those 13,900 deaths involve suicides. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't address that. We ought to address that sometime, but that's not the same thing as mass shootings, and it's not what would be affected by a limitation, for instance, on assault weapons. So if we're going to talk about assault weapons and mass shootings, then let's talk about assault weapons and mass shootings, right? So when people, and sometimes people just get confused about it and they don't realize that there's a difference, and so they'll just throw it out there. Oh, man, the number one cause of deaths in, you know, teenagers and kids this year is gun violence. And then they'll say, so we need these restrictions. And I understand that. It makes sense. You're asking for a restriction on something that's involved in the death of so many people. But what we don't want to do is use artificial language to create an unnecessary barrier between the ideas that we're presenting that are legitimate about what could be done to make a difference, and then the minds of those who know where that artificial line has been drawn by us. Because if we're saying 13,900 lives could have been saved with assault weapons restrictions, that's just not the case. That's not what we're talking about. And it's not what I'm talking about today. But I do think we ought to have some restrictions in place. I do think we ought to have some protections in place, and I do think it's worth us talking about and doing, but I also recognize that that doesn't mean it's going to save 13,900 lives per year. And by the way, if it did, the response to that would be, well, there are 300 million people in the country. 13,900 is not that many. I mean, after all, there are more people who die from pneumonia than die from blah, blah, blah. So it's more about what values we're willing to talk about at the end of the day than the statistics. But we can't get to those values unless we use honest statistics. So I just want to start with a recognition of what we're actually describing here. So again, out of all those deaths, more than half of those are suicides. And out of all those shootings that have taken place, and I don't know what the total number of shootings was, but it's a lot. I mean, thousands. 460 of those were law enforcement officers. I'm not saying all of those were just or not just, different conversation, but we all know that's a completely different ballgame when you're talking about an officer responding to a call for some kind of help, some kind of violence is going on, something's happening, and they're taking a weapon into it, that creates a different scenario. That's a different discussion. We're not talking about restricting whether police officers can carry guns or assault weapons or something like that. That's not the idea here. We're also not talking about all the accidental shootings that took place, although that's worth talking about. Again, it is a worthwhile conversation when kids find guns in their parents' house and are able to use them or just play with them and then end up shooting their two-year-old sibling. However, you also have to acknowledge, I mean, those cases are already prosecuted pretty strongly on the parents who were involved. So I'm not saying that it shouldn't be talked about. It should be talked about. We ought to do more about it and more about creating a safe environment for those kids that are affected as well. There were 494 of those accidental type shootings, whatever the accident was. Almost 600 teenagers and kids have been killed with firearms this year. And again, that's just 2023 through May, through the beginning of May. So we're not talking about the whole year or anything like that. But again, these are all kinds of shootings, and they're not exclusive of the other topics. Law enforcement involvement or accidental shootings or suicides, all of those things are involved in that. So those are not the statistics I'm responding to today or trying to talk about. What I'm talking about are the mass shootings. Those are the provocateur for the talk that we need to have today. And, you know, just these, the fact that there were 13 shootings in a K through 12 setting, in primary and secondary education settings, 13 shootings during the first four to four and a half months of 2023 is enough to get our attention, right? I mean, nobody sends their kids to school without having had a conversation about mass shootings anymore. There are no schools where kids haven't been instructed what to do, where to go, where to hide if a shooter shows up. Why does everybody have to be familiar with the language active shooter? Why is that common parlance in our culture? And it would be enough for that to be common parlance. Would you think a school was being responsible if having 13 shootings in the first 4 months in our country, if that school did not prepare or instruct their leadership and their students about how to respond in an active shooter setting? So now we're in a society where we're acknowledging we have to tell all of our kids what to do when an active shooter comes to their school. Then we probably need to talk about this as a society on how we ought to stop that from happening. And there are a lot of people who do talk about it. But I mean, we need to talk about it where both sides of the conversation are heard and there's some kind of progress made instead of being in exactly the same spot every single time it happens. So 13 of those shootings, and there was another college shooting this year at Michigan State up in Lansing, Michigan. There were, by definition, of the one that I gave earlier, and again, that definition is wobbly. There are so many variables on how you define it, you know, whether a victim is somebody who dies or somebody who's just injured, and so on, and how close in proximity they have to be, how much time can go by, all that kind of stuff. I get it. But approximately 184, that's the number, 183 to 184, now that Allen has happened, shootings, mass shootings, January through May of 2023. And so in that, that's the context that I'm talking about. In that context of those mass shootings, just those 184 mass shootings, or even if it were just the 13 school shootings, or the 13 school shootings plus a handful that took place in a mall, or that took place in an entertainment venue, where people are doing nothing but just trying to pass the time, and they end up being targets of gunfire. If you just take those, it's enough for us to have a conversation and say, how are we supposed to respond to this? What are we supposed to do as a society in response to this? And you know that there are three parts to this that I'll mention right now that I think are just obvious. Number one, that you eliminate the immediate threat. I mean, I know there are some people who are so committed to sort of a pacifist approach to life that they would not even accept this one. But that's, a very minor proportion of our society and culture. And so I'm not going to delve into that argument today. We're not going to get into pacifism as an argument. And again, not because it's not worth having the conversation, and especially for Christians, it is definitely worth having that conversation. But that's just not the point today. We know that in the moment when something is going on, there needs to be an elimination of the immediate threat. And that's why we are so grateful, and I am too, when first responders respond first. why we're so confused, why we're dismayed when they linger at the perimeter or in hallways. It's just we can't even comprehend it. And I'm not there. I wasn't there. So I'm not even judging those individuals as individuals. But I am saying as a society, we're utterly confused about what happened in Uvalde. What was going on there? And the reason for that is because we are so grateful when what happens in Allen does. And that man is willing, that officer was willing to run directly toward this unbelievable danger and stop it before more people had to die. So thank God, literally, for him. And for that that first responder, and for every first responder who's done that and who's willing to do that for us, we are thankful for that. This is part of that number one part of the response. It's always going to be something we want, someone to respond that way. And that's why we're so grateful for the heroes, the teachers, and the adults who lay on top of children when things like this are happening in order to keep them safe. And we all know those stories. And who could ever thank them for long enough? Record their name permanently enough to say that's why you live, to be able to protect someone in that moment. So the elimination of the immediate threat is obviously that's the first thing that has to happen. No, I don't know anyone in this conversation that's questioning that or wondering about that. And I do, as a side note, want to just get the words thank you out there to those who do something in that moment to try to protect people. Secondly, after the elimination of the immediate threat, right? After the person has been stopped, apprehended, even killed, whatever has to happen, you just have to stop it. After that, the care for the survivors, you know, is immediate. Those who come out on the other side, you cannot predict or control, nor should we, what they're going to face. They may come out on the other side in shock with no idea what has happened, no ability to recall anything. They may be angry. They may be morose. They may be silent. They might become loud. They might become activist. They might be withdrawn. They might be confused. They might just be lost. But what they cannot be is alone. And I don't mean by that they can't have time to themselves to think through. I don't mean that. But what we offer, and this is what I have this certificate. It's, you know, I'm not pretending like this makes me an expert, but I have this certificate in victim chaplaincy. And it's, you know, in the wake of 9/11, after 2001, a lot of us went through training because we saw the catastrophe that followed in 9/11 were the survivors who needed someone to help them spiritually through what they were facing. And there just wasn't enough training of ministers at the time to understand what was needed in that environment. And so there was a really mounted effort. And at the time, by the way, we were still in the throes of anticipating a lot more terrorist attacks. We didn't know the extent of what was going to happen immediately after 9/11. And so there was a lot of, we're going to have a training, come and get this certification so that if something happens in our city, you'll be available for the victims. And in the context of that training especially, I was more exposed than any other setting. I have been taught this in other places too, but more exposed there than anywhere else of the importance of the what they referred to as the ministry of presence, which was not trying to answer questions, not trying to solve the problem, not trying to fix attitudes, not trying to explain things, but simply being there. That if someone said, "Why did this happen?" the ability to say, "I don't know, but I know you're not alone," is what you communicate. And that's what we do when we're serving people so many times. And for those of you who've done that, you know, at the end of the day, that's what a person needs, is just someone to be there with them. And for us to be available, the ministry of presence is a big part of what we're able to do as believers. So I'm saying the first two parts of our response in these types of settings is obvious. Eliminate the threat first. No argument about that. Nobody's arguing that there shouldn't have been someone to stop that shooter in Allen or in Nashville, or, and thank God for those who stopped them, that person as well. But in every circumstance, stop, eliminate the immediate threat. Secondly, though, care for the survivors, because the whole culture, the whole society is affected by it. But the people who were traumatized right there need someone to help them and to know that they are not on their own. And in a lot of cases, the survivors of these events, and think of the Sandy Hook elementary survivors, especially the parents and the others affected by it, they became sort of adversaries to a huge swath of our culture because we didn't want to hear what they had gone through. We didn't want to deal with the implications of what that shooting meant for our society. And so just learning to care for survivors is a topic for another conversation. And obviously in this conversation to say we have to have that at the front of our minds. It's not a matter of saying, I have the solution, we just need gun control, or I have the solution, we just need mental health care, or I have the solution, we need more access to guns. That's not good enough for someone who just went through a traumatic event like this. And providing care for them should come before we're all imposing our solutions on things. But then, after the elimination of the immediate threat, after we've taken into consideration just caring for the survivors, we have to do something to reduce or eliminate whatever persistent threat there is, whatever threat remains to the society. And you say, well, the person's dead, there's no more threat. We know that's not true. And let's just go back to inductive logic for a moment. Let's say I've got a blind corner, and I do, in my office. And I walk down the hall 10 times a day. I walk down the hall, and I turn that corner. And every time I walk down the hall and turn the corner, I'm listening for other people's footsteps because it's a blind corner. And people walk down the hall pretty quickly sometimes, the crossway, the T of the hall that I'm talking about. So let's say I do that and I have one collision. In all the times I walk down the hall, I have one collision. Okay, fine. Meh. Whatever. Doesn't matter. I'm not going to change anything. I'm going to walk down the hall. I'm going to listen for footsteps. I'm going to slow down a little bit. Maybe the first few times I slow down a lot when I turn that corner, but it's not going to change anything. Maybe if I have one collision a year, meh, whatever. That's not going to change my behavior either. Oh, sorry, excuse me, bumped into you. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah. But if I'll give you two cases in which I'm going to do something different. If every week I run into somebody, oh, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry I've knocked you on the ground and broken your hip again. I didn't mean to do it. And you're right, we should put a mirror up in the hallway. But you know, mirrors cost money, and then people are able to see what other people are doing that violates your privacy, and it's just all this, you know, maybe we'll get around to it. We'll see if we can get a bill passed by the Student Government Association to get a mirror up in the hallway there. If I'm bumping into somebody every week, I'm going to put a mirror up and I'm going to fix the problem. Inductive logic says I'm doing this enough that I should do something to fix it, or there's something wrong with the way my mind is working, right? Not complicated. By the way, the other thing that would make me change it and do something about it is if when I did have that one collision in the year, I broke my hip. I'd be saying, put a mirror up there. I don't want to break my hip again. I'm not doing that again. You can tell I'm thinking about getting older, right? I'm breaking hips now. Not shins, not thighs, not cool things, just hips. And I'm not saying breaking your hip makes you uncool. If you're older and listening, God bless you. Glad you have a hip. Okay, so anyway, here's the point. Inductive logic does say at some point, events are repetitive enough that you have to start paying attention to them. And you have to do something about them. You have to recognize that when they're repeated, if you did nothing to change the circumstance, then something's wrong with you. And that's what I'm saying about our society. There are some repetitive elements to these shootings that we ought to be taking into consideration. You know, among the incidents, and I will link to an article, this one in Newsweek. Yes, major media, I get it. But again, the data's not really disputed on this. That the fact that assault weapons were involved in any way, present, actually fired, whatever, in 26% of these shootings doesn't mean we can solve all the other shootings with anything done about assault weapons. It also doesn't mean there aren't other solutions to those, by the way, to the shootings that don't involve assault weapons that we ought to be considering, and we should. But it does mean if these shootings take place this often, with enough frequency that we're finding ourselves on our backside in the hallway going, oh, another one? There was another one? And this isn't falling down, and it isn't breaking your hip. It's people being slaughtered in the places they ought to be protected. Then you would think that we would say to ourselves, well, let's do something to promote some safety. So here's a quotation from that article in Newsweek. Among those incidents, the ones that involved assault weapons, assault rifles, are some of the deadliest mass shootings in the nation's history. This is not complicated because the assault weapon makes it possible to kill a lot more people. That's what they're designed for. That's the thing they do by definition, is kill a lot more people a lot more efficiently. That some of the deadliest mass shootings in the nation's history involve those assault weapons, including the Las Vegas shooting, which left 59 people dead. The Orlando, Florida nightclub shooting, which killed 50. The Sandy Hook Elementary shooting in Connecticut, which killed 28, including all those kids. I mean, I have a list of them in front of me, these ones that took place over the last dozen years or so. And by the way, that article in Newsweek was written in the wake of a shooting that took place in Boulder that week. But you'll remember, and these are the ones that connected with me, the Midland-Odessa Interstate shooting, the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting in 2018, the Sutherland Springs, Texas shooting, remember? In South Texas, in one of our churches. The Las Vegas shooting that I just mentioned, the shooting in Plano in 2017, the Orlando nightclub in 2016, that mass murder, the Colorado Springs shooting, the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting, those all involved assault weapons in some way or another. And by the way, I'm not trying to ignore the fact that handguns are far and away the most commonly used weapon in mass shootings. And let me just pause here, and we'll end in a moment, and we'll sort of cut it off here and come back to the conversation for those of you who are willing to do it. The thing on handguns is, if you say, why are you talking about assault weapons? Handguns we're involved in. You know why we're talking about assault weapons? Because when we talk about handguns, we find ourselves deported from the country next week. Nobody's willing to talk about that. How about we ban handguns? I can't even get the sentence out before somebody's taking you down. It's not a realistic conversation right now. I'm not saying it shouldn't be talked about in some way, but it's not realistic. It's not going to happen. Assault weapons? Man, that doesn't seem like an irrational conversation. And based on the events that were made much worse because of their presence, maybe something should happen with it. So what I would like for us to do is I've heard a lot of people, including conservative Republicans, and I mean conservative Republicans, even them say, maybe it's time for some common sense gun reform. And they speak about it in terms of red flag laws, background checks, even at gun shows, and then some kind of a ban or limitation on semi-automatic assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Those three steps in common sense gun reform are topics of conversation that people might be willing to put on the table right now. And I think we should talk about them in terms of some general responses and objections to some objections and some responses to those and so on. But also in light of why on earth this has become such an important issue to such a broad swath of our Christian community. That's something worth talking about. And so what I want to do is come back and have that conversation. And the object of all of this is just that we know as believers that we want our values reflected in our society. And we want our society to find a better way of valuing things when something's wrong with it. And so my prayer is that in having these conversations, we could at least start down the road of doing better and doing it soon and maybe even now. So let's pick up the conversation again next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.